We're recording. This is MR Radio. I'm GW, and Daniel is with me online as usual. Today, our guest is the driving force behind the new Right Forum in London, and he is Jez Turner. Jez is an ex-soldier. He's had an interesting life, therefore, and he describes his philosophy as being of the instinct, and himself as being a speaker for those who believe in identity. Description which he wrote of himself in, where was it, Jez, you were saying?
Right, it's an online magazine called European Outlook.
Right.
And it's published by Bill Bailey, who's been around a very long time, long time.
Yes, I received emails.
That's right. So I had to answer 5 questions in January issue this year. And the first question was, who are you? So this is what I wrote. I wrote, I'm English, I'm British, I'm European, I'm white, I'm a man. In my own way, I'm an activist, an organizer, a writer, and a speaker on behalf of those who believe in the importance of identity, and who realize that identity, together with all the things that make life worthwhile, are facing annihilation. I'm an identitarian, which means I'm a nationalist for all nations and a patriot for all patriots. But as a white man, a European, a Briton, and an Englishman, I necessarily put my own people first. We must secure an existence for white people and a future for white children. And I would add 5 more words to that. We must and we will.
Right. Well, I hope we do. Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much, Jez, for coming on the show. You sent a list of 3 subjects which you considered it would be interesting to debate, and the first of those was the Charlie Hebdo massacre, the meaning of it, how it's going to run from here on in, really, because we know what happened. There's no point in going over any of that. But what was your own immediate response to the whole thing? I mean, did you see it as being an opportunity for us?
Well, whatever happens in this world is an opportunity for us and for our enemies. Our enemies control the mass media, they control everything worth controlling, they own everything worth owning, so they can interpret whatever happens in the way they want to interpret it. But we have a chance because of this Je suis Charlie Hebdo, this freedom of speech bandwagon that's rolling. So my immediate reaction was Je suis Robert Faurisson and the other historians who've been imprisoned for their views. Je suis Vagn Vikernes, who's the black metal musician who was prosecuted in Paris. Je suis Signe, S-I-N-E, I'm not sure how you pronounce this cartoonist's name, Signe, but he was the only cartoonist that Charlie Hebdo ever, who has ever done a mildly critical cartoon of the Jews. If you recall, Nicolas Sarkozy's son married a very rich Jewish heiress, and Signe did a cartoon saying, smart boy, we'll go far. And he was told by the editor, you must withdraw this cartoon or else. You must withdraw this cartoon. And Signe said, I would rather cut off my testicles than withdraw. Sacked from Charlie Hebdo.
And then you were mentioning the British cartoonist that was
Je suis Robert Edwards. He was imprisoned for a year in 1981. He's the only British political cartoonist ever to be imprisoned for his cartoons. And
what was the cartoon?
It was mildly critical of various politically correct.
Mildly critical when he went to jail?
He did a cartoon, a sort of comic strip, Billy the Yid. Dresden and Auschwitz, the facts, that sort of thing, yeah. And they put him in prison for it. It's just we do Donne. I mean, he's a French comedian, but he's always in trouble with the French, and he's banned from giving public performances. Just we Jean-Marie Le Pen, you know, his detail comments, you know, the Holocaust is a detail of the Second World War. It's even less than that. It didn't even occur in anybody's memoirs about the Second World War for many, many years. Just we Tim Wilcox, the BBC journalist, who had the temerity to say, well, aren't Jews persecuting Palestinians, you know, and he may lose his job over that. Je suis Robert Brassillac, who was executed after the Second World War. He was merely a novelist, a writer, a philosopher. Je suis Simon Shepherd and who's the other chap? Stephen Whittle.
Yeah.
Who were imprisoned for posting something on an American website and went to get political asylum from
asylum.
The land of the free, you know, the land of the enslaved, more like, and they were sent back and put in prison. Je suis, you know, Charlie Maurras. Je suis Charlie Charles Martel. Repel the Moors at Tours. Now, I would like to do a spoof edition of Charlie Hebdo. Same cover, same title and everything. And I would have on the front of it Garen Helm's cartoon of Luciana Berger with her yellow star on her forehead and trusted you to show her colours every time. And then every page would have a different individual who has been imprisoned for free speech. Robert Edwards, all persecuted. Tim Wilcox, the journalist. Jean-Marie Le Pen, you know, sign. Robert Forrison, Simon Shepherd, Stephen Whittle, Varg Vikernes. You know, all these people, Dudonne, and put it out and see what the liberal reaction would be to that.
I was thinking about this Charlie Hebdo issue, that they're obviously going to try to put their spin on it, and they're trying to turn it into a free speech issue, but it's an occasion for us to decide how it counts as we see it, and therefore it's not something to ignore.
I think we have to drum home the obvious fact that this freedom of speech that they bang on about
doesn't exist,
and secondly, it's only freedom for obscenity, freedom for hardcore pornography, freedom for these topless women from femen to shout obscenities in churches and urinate on altars, you know, femen funded by Jewish men, you know.
But think about it, think through it for a second. If we're able to retake Europe and have it for ours, you know, you're not going to turn free speech at that point into a universal item where people can just say and do anything. There's still going to be limits on free speech. So
you say that, but for the greater part of history, there have not been limits on free speech because they were not required in a
exactly.
You know, in a healthy, homogenous society where you don't
have
fundamental.
Well, I guess you just wouldn't say things that were offensive to people around you, but still, you would know the limits.
No. I don't agree with you. Many conflicts have been generated over the last 6-7 decades, which require power to impose control. Otherwise, the whole thing would shake itself apart. It's as simple as that. Prior to the Second World War, we were a substantially ethnically homogenous country. Europe was substantially racially homogenous. And the result of that was that there were not the same conflicts and there were not the same opportunities or desires for people to attack other parts of the racial body, if you're with me. Even class war has had to have been manufactured. It is not real. And when push came to shove, of course, in 1923, the Bolsheviks and all the rest of it, actually Jews, realized that they couldn't break everything up using class war because it wasn't going to be taken up by the masses. So, you know, you have to assume that in a healthy society, homogenous society, the conflicts wouldn't be there.
Okay.
No control would be required, would it?
It could be all the free speech.
There's no police.
That's not the big problem. But it's incumbent upon us to make sure that the immigration issue is not swept aside, and that the genetic issue is not swept aside.
No, that's the principal issue. If you assume that, for instance, power is generating all of this, then of course power becomes the principal issue. But
I think all this
first strangle the dog, don't they say?
There is rent-a-mob, professional agitators who come out onto the streets very quickly after any event, and it's choreographed. It's almost in Paris, it was state-organized, a bit like, you know, Stalinist Russia, state-organized demonstrations. And the whole point of this is to take the issue away from the real issue, and the real issue is immigration. Free speech is a white people thing. We don't need to bang on about it because it is natural to us. We don't need to have laws telling us what we can say and not say, because we have good manners. And as long as I don't say, go and kill Mr. X, then anything's allowed. We never used to have a police force, remember? We never really used to have a police force. We had the sheriff who would come in if necessary. White people are generally law-abiding as long as they live in a homogeneous society. We don't really need that much police, and we certainly don't need laws about what we can say and can't say.
I agree. It's my experience too.
So the other element in all of this, which is raising its head, is the security services who are taking advantage of the situation. There's been a parade of people traipsing onto the media. We've had the Home Secretary, of course, and today I noticed Malcolm Rifkin in the Telegraph, and they're all trying to get it, you know, out there that we're losing the information war against the terrorists, and we're going to need to have this law, this law, this law. So that's the other sort of thing which seems to me to be a very strong part of the aftershock. I don't see in the Charlie Hebdo thing very much more than that. You know, some nationalists do. I mean, Nick Griffin was very, very quick to come out with a piece which said, oh, this is a defining moment, and, you know, people can see the Muslims. Well, to my mind, we have to be aware that we are required to concentrate a lot on the Muslim problem, not to look elsewhere. So, you know, to me, there are dangers in this thing for us as well as advantages. But I suspect that this whole thing will gradually fade away. The forces of the state will take their profit from it. Jews will take their profit from it. And we'll be left with a dispensation which is slightly less favourable to us than the one that existed before.
I slightly disagree with you. I think that violence is golden, in a sense, because violence wakes us up. Violence, you know, knocks us out of our liberal
But we've had the most
dream.
Fantastic amounts of violence already, and we simply adapt to it. You are not allowing for the really, you know, very pleasing, in some ways, capacity for European peoples to take damage and still to come back, you know, turn the other cheek. It goes back to World War II. You only got to look at the efforts that were made both by the Germans, World War One, in fact, the efforts that were made to produce a failure of war will among the population through aerial bombing, you know, absolutely phenomenal efforts that had zero effect.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. You see, corruption is the real enemy. Corruption leads to destruction. Corrupting a people destroys them, but violence just actually wakes them up. It actually creates a blowback. It makes them realize what reality is. There's two realities. There's a false media reality, the liberal dream, and then there's the real reality. And violence cuts through that liberal dream and wakes people up. Now, my opposition to Islam is not because they're against liberalism. You see what I'm saying? You know, Islam is very good in Islamic countries. I don't want it in Europe. But I'm not opposed to Islam because it's illiberal, anti-liberal.
No. I mean, I'm not. I don't have any view of Islam at all, particularly other than the historical one, that you know, it's obviously an expansive ideology, and it isn't an ideology that would help us. To me, it's another form of Judaism for the Gentile. Many of its most strident features are clearly related to the strident features of Judaism, but just turned through, you know, 90 degrees. What we have to do, obviously, is to use whatever Islam does that's negative
in
society, yes, okay. But I don't believe we're going to free ourselves because of the nature of Islam, any more than we would free ourselves because of the sociobiology of Africans. You know, criminal records and all the rest of it, you know, there's looting and things that happen. None of these things really lead to a new dawn. We have to find a active way to express our own political paradigm. We can't rely on these sort of possible gifts from outside.
That makes sense.
You know, we've had such a long period now of waiting for breakthroughs, doing what we can on the internet and all the rest of it. And, you know, to my mind, this should have led to a huge racing sort of Australian-style fire on the ground decades ago. We should have woken up decades ago. We should have woken up in Powell's time. We should have woken up when the National Front started to make a few moves, then the British National Party in 2009. We should have woken up. So I don't know how one overcomes this problem by simply waiting for events to help us. We've got to get beyond that way of thinking.
I think events can wake up individuals, and yes, the people we have to the best people will begin to wake up, the natural leaders. Most people will never wake up. They have to be led. Now, I think we've been too much waiting for the cavalry to come. We've been waiting for the mass of people to wake up. Well, we're the cavalry. Nationalists, whatever name we call ourselves, are the natural leaders of a people. And we're the people who've got to lead and wake the people up. And we can't just sit back and hope for things to happen. We've got to noblesse oblige. You know, we've got to get in there and get in the front line and get things working, get things to get. You know, there's too much demand for middle class respectability. We can't get involved in nationalism, it's too dangerous, too violent, might get a prison record, might get a police record, might lose my job. It goes on and on and on and on. You know, there's nothing respectable about cowardice. There's nothing respectable about letting your people being gang raped and sold into slavery and destroyed.
No, but I mean, there's a case in point.
That's one of the motivating factors that Strawn is citing as that which will gather the masses to fight, is the humanitarian ideal. That's one that still has currency, along with higher national ideals and booty.
But, you know, if we were going to be humanitarian about this whole thing, would we not have reacted as a people, I mean, not just as nationalists, much, much more decisively when the news of the Rotherham affair, which has been replicated in 50, you know, other places in the United Kingdom. It's not just Rotherham, but...
But see, GW and Jez, that's the problem. Nationalists, they're insufficiently emancipated from Jewish influence, and as a result, they're just reacting. They're taking this. Okay, we're rightists. Well, everything about being a leftist corresponds with social concern, with humanitarian ideals, and that's why I'm satisfied that we've got to call ourselves leftists of a white fashion. That begins to invoke the humanitarian ideal and the higher national ideal and the fair distribution of social resource of human and other capital. And it allows us to keep an eye on the greatest potential. It has us naturally keeping an eye on the greatest potential traitors, the elites, and also the greatest mass of the disaffected, those who are being screwed, who have no incentive to participate in the maintenance of the system.
All right, well, let's move on a little bit, since you've mentioned the higher national ideal. Jez sent me this little list. Point number 2 says... This, too much materialism, short-termism, right, and lack of a transcendental outlook.
Great concern.
Yeah, okay. So, when we're talking about materialism, Jez, how would you define that in the life that we're leading?
Many people, they look at the British National Party and they say, what did it achieve? What did it achieve? We've no buildings, we've no nationalist headquarters, we've no... nationalist newspapers, we've no nationalist printing presses. But I think that's a materialistic, sort of almost liberal way of looking at things, because the sort of success we seek is to sow seeds in the minds of men. And I think we have to get out of this liberal drift, this short-termism, this cowardice, because if we're materialists, we don't believe in anything higher, anything... It's just us here, this generation. That's all that matters. Me, perhaps my family, that's it. We have to start thinking in an intergenerational way, in a transcendental way, perhaps. We have to stop thinking short-term. The fight to liberate our race, to ensure our race survives, may take 1,000 years. It's not going to be 20 years. True, we have to do something now, but in a sense, there are two wars any man has to fight. There is the war within his own soul, to improve himself, to be the best he can be. And then there is the external war, the war on behalf of his people, to protect his people. And here's the very important point. The best way of fighting the internal war, the war in your own soul, is to fight the external war. And in a sense, whether the external war is a defeat or a victory does not matter too much as far as your soul is concerned. The important thing is you fight.
That's great. And there's another sense which, even if they win, they're not winning. They're not achieving the goal that you're seeking to achieve. So they're not really winning.
Well, if they blend us out in the bottomless seas of the third world, as they say, we've lost. I mean, we've gone.
Mm.
When we talked the other day to Paul, he was saying, this is Paul Weston, he was saying that about Islam is that it has its bloody borders and all the rest of it, and it reminds us of the seriousness of our situation. If it wasn't for reminders, we would just sleep on and wake up in 40 years and it would be too late.
Mm.
I mean, putting it into perspective, you know, you talk about materialism, but the one thing that people have shown that they are not willing to risk is their material existence, their well-being and security. A lot of them think, well, you know, I've got my kids. It's my kids I have to look out for. So
it's hard for me to offer advice as to how to get other people to act to think this way, because I already do.
That's correct.
It's necessary for me to think somewhat transcendently of the race, because
you're one of Jez's natural elites. You know, this is not
nice
your. Well, of course you are. It's not for you to, in a way, it's not for you to pass judgment on these, you know, people for the fact that they want to preserve their material existence, their standard of living. And you know, they want to be able to give their children everything that they need in life, and more besides, and you know, to be a good parent and all the rest of it. And these are
I don't think that Jez is looking to take that away from people.
No.
He just wants to think of more.
Yes.
Is that right, Jez?
Yes, but
yeah. Well,
if you criticize materialism, you have to be sure what you're criticizing. There's materialism, which is beyond critique, to be perfectly honest. So, what are we really talking about? Are we talking about
short-termism?
Short-termism,
selfishness, excesses. People have got to realize that they can perhaps look after their 2.4 children very nicely for the next 30 years, but then what? Because they're going to lose all these good things anyway eventually. We have a duty to past generations and a duty to future generations, and the first priority is to make sure there are future generations. Yes, I mean, it's short-termism, really. If our people are not waking up, if they're still brainwashed, it's the nationalist elite's fault that they're not waking up.
Right.
There's something we're doing wrong that is not waking them up. That's our job.
Yes. So what it comes down to then is, after all these years, how do we actually address our own people?
Don't we have to show an interest in the people who are being marginalized, the ones who are being most affected? Don't we have to take an interest in creating a place for people to take monogamy and relationships absolutely seriously?
You know, when the National Socialists, for the only example we've really got, came to power, they did so because, according to Adolf, the Volkisch movement did not know how to get its people on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Volkisch movement had a much more transcendental, a more philosophical outlook. It still had some of the same characteristics,
we don't want those herds. We want people acting out of we want a full
yeah. But what I'm saying is that
we want a full narrative of concern that people act out of. Just naturally, so that if one English guy realizes this needs to be done, he's not marching in lockstep with others who've been trained that it needs to be done. He just knows that this has to be done, and that's how the culture is protected and the people are maintained. Not because they're regimented
No, of course not. The point I'm trying to make is that there is a clear dividing line between a kind of discourse that leads to social conservatism, which is a very healthy thing, and a kind of discourse that leads to political power.
Can I just get in there? I would say that your comments on 1930s in Germany is very useful, because the National Socialist Movement, all the work was done before it came on the scene. You had the Volkisch movement, you had the revolutionary conservatives.
Yes.
Those prepared the ground.
Yeah.
The NS movement came along and just, boom, tug that. So the hard work was done. And, you know, it wasn't a case of putting the cart before the horse. The cart was there. NS came along and that was the horse. And, you know, we've got to build a sort of positive, authentic, organic option for people. We've got to present nationalism in an optimistic, positive way, not just negative banging on the way. We've got to create a cultural, social, political...
The negative has completely failed. That's what we've been trying for the last five decades, for sure, and it has totally and completely failed. I mean, it's true what we say about liberalism. The critique is correct. It's been going on for a very long time. Hegel criticized liberalism in his premier work, and Heidegger did, Carl Schmitt, of course, famously, you know, Nietzsche. But we can't approach the people with that. We have to give them a way forward. I've been over these various interviews we've done recently, I've been asking people, well, okay, what can you say that's positive? And I haven't had a reply. That's true, isn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so I say to them, well, okay, our numbers are terrible or whatever, we're in trouble here, we're in trouble there, but what is the positive message that you can give? What actual incentive can you provide for people? And immediately they go straight back into, oh, well, yeah, okay, if we don't do this, it's all going to... No. You've gone back into the negative again. Come on, think positively. And it seems to me that we are so enamored with negative analysis, and we're so habituated in it.
Well, one of the things that gives Islam such power is that it apparently treats sex as a sacrament of some sort. It takes it seriously. And that's probably why some women even respect it, even though it doesn't respect them, because it's taking these important matters seriously in a way that liberalism doesn't. There's no reason for us not to offer it. It doesn't matter if 2% of the population wants this. It should be something that's institutionalized. This here is an enclave for people who, you know, just they want one partner for life. That's it. This is the most serious thing in the world for them.
I think Islam is obviously a serious religion, and I have known people from various Islamic countries who don't believe in God, but they believe in Islam. Now that's important, because Islam looks after people. It looks after everyone, from the very poor, and it makes them all have a responsibility for the tribe, for the ummah. Now that is common sense. But we've lost that in the West. We've lost that.
Right, and that's what we were talking about. You were mentioning how you respect an idea of roles for everybody being the whole people.
Exactly.
The whole people of the nation, and not the people divided against each other. There can be wealthy people that will obviously have different abilities, but you know, you'll have a Greg Johnson who will be an excellent philosopher, but you'll have skinhead types as well, and they'll be respected for what they do. And
yes, whites are immensely varied and different in our capabilities and our outlooks and our viewpoints, and we've got to cater for those different people, and one size does not fit all. There was a girl who worked for Charlie Hebdo, and she was interviewed by Radio 4 or the World Service, and she was saying, well, why can't Islam be like every other religion in the West? Well, the point is, every other religion in the West has been undermined, subverted, destroyed. Islam hasn't yet been liberalized like that, so that's why it's different, and that's why it's got more common sense about it. You know, Christianity used to look after people. You know, we used to have the monasteries, used to have the, you know, we didn't need workhouses.
Salvation Army.
Monasteries. Salvation Army, exactly. Yes, you know.
And Islam also has an eye on usury and exploitation from the elites, and that's why I prefer to fashion a white leftist perspective, because it will naturally have us keeping an eye on the elites, their proclivity to betray us.
It's common sense, because, you know, the standard view of most middle-class whites is, well, if people are stupid enough to borrow money from Wonga or go and gamble away their house in Las Vegas, then sod them. Well, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. There are people, we have to protect them, we have to look after them. We have to get rid of these Wonga loans, these usurers, these loan sharks. We have to get rid of these super casinos, because a lot of people will be tricked into signing away their house you know, they'll be tricked into gambling it away. They'll be tricked in this. This is why we have to look after our people. We have to resurrect this idea of noblesse oblige. We have to. They are people after all. Without them, you can't have a society just of middle class people. It won't survive. You know, you need all the people, the whole tribe, the whole nation.
Oddly enough, I mean, I think there's a general feeling out there now developing quite quickly. I mean, it's very much coming from the left. This French guy, Piketty. Yeah, you know, the economist who, he's come up with this very obvious idea that Jim Barry cottoned on to years ago, that we're moving into a world in which the middle class are disappearing, and there's going to be a single class of essentially enslaved, compliant consumers, and that's the kind of world that we are.
I agree.
Moving towards, so
I agree.
You know,
the middle class are their competition.
So we're moving forward a little bit with this debate, because now we can say, well, there is a politics that might appeal to the middle class, a nationalist politics that might appeal to the middle class, which gave them responsibility. In other words, the left of centre responsibility for their fellow man, alongside sufficient recognition, economic recognition, for their capacities and the risks that they take, and so on and so forth, economically.
And they can also, they're also better positioned to keep an eye on those who are yet above to make sure.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Because politics is substantially a middle class pursuit. And I mean, the political class,
they're next in line.
Journalists, you know, these are all middle class people, and it may be possible to make a politics for the middle class. Because for one thing, if we're asking people to really dissect and understand the meaning of the age in which we live politically, they do have, the average intelligence is probably something like 115, the capacity to do that. It may be a little higher than that, actually. So, you know, different situation with the working class, where you've got an average intelligence probably somewhere around about 95. You know, an awfully big effort is being directed at them from BNP and the EDL to try to get them to, you know, wake up, to look around. And, you know, the numbers just aren't there. They're not forthcoming. So maybe, and we're seeing in UKIP, you know, what the middle class can really do.
Exactly. Look, I mean, for far too long we've aimed too low. We've aimed for the football hooligans, the skinheads. There's no point. Aim high. Trickle-down effect will get them anyway.
Yes.
And these people you mentioned aren't natural leaders except in their own little community. We have to say to the middle class, stop being selfish and end the selfishness now. In return for these benefits that you will get as being middle class, you have duties. You have duties to look after the working class. Don't just shove them on a council estate somewhere and complain about them. Yeah,
That's the deal. So the thing is that we do not want to carry forward distinctions and difference that are in conflict. You accept distinctions and difference. You cohere them in the interests of the whole.
But right, and I really think that it would help to get away from this this idea of being against equality. It's the stupidest phraseology that.
Well, that comes.
We're against equality. That's ridiculous.
I know, but that's that. Well, I mean, de Benoist, isn't it, really, and the cynic, who've produced that. So, yeah, you're quite right. I don't think equality in itself is not bad in itself, if it's pitched at the right level. But it is not a cause.
It's appreciate, you know, that we're not the same. It's a qualitative matter. It's a big difference between not being the same and not being equal.
Yes, we're not in business to generate equality. You can't impose it. As soon as you start to...
Not even trying. It's just not the matter. It's the wrong framework. It's the wrong...
Well, it's part of...
It's an automatic insult. There's nothing good. It's like, it just, you know, you're...
Well, we must remember people are different, and that phrase will appeal to some people.
Different, you know, being different is fine. You know, talking in terms of difference, not being the same. To say that nothing's equal, I mean, it's automatically snobbery, elitism, putting other people down, false comparisons.
It's both.
Wrong term.
Equality has to be intellectualized in a new way, and not as a cause in opposition to inequality. There is, in fact, no equality in nature, which is a point I often make. That there's only difference in nature, and we need to understand how these two concepts of difference and equality, they're different. They're different in themselves, and they do not actually refer to one another. They enter at different places, if you like, and we need to work that out and see where it takes us, perhaps.
There's no equality in nature, but if you look at a herd of wildebeest, a pack of wolves, they look after each other. I saw a very interesting nature program, Richard Attenborough, and these wolves were chasing these buffaloes, no, these bison, actually. In a sense, the bison kept the weak ones, the not-so-very-fast bison, alive, and you thought, well, why did they do that? And then the wolf pack came along, okay? And the bison were, the herd began to panic and ran. Mm. And there was a few stray bison behind, some strong ones, you know, strong, fast bison left behind, who were sort of like the rear guard, coming up behind, several hundred yards behind. And the wolf pack was chasing the main herd, ignored these stragglers, ignored them, because the wolves knew they were strong bison. And they went for the pack. And gradually, from the pack, a weaker bison began to lag behind. And the wolves hung on to him. They hung on to him. There was seven wolves hanging on to this bison. And then you saw as the camera was watching this bison slow down with these wolves. He was still going, though. He was still going. He wasn't giving up. You saw some of these faster bison behind gallop past. When the last bison came near this injured bison, suddenly, boom, the bison's horns hit the rear of this bison that was being attacked by the wolves, and the bison rolled over, and the wolves pounced on top of the bison. And the commentator said, oh, a bit of luck for the wolves. That was not luck at all. That was done on purpose. That rear bison knew that the herd had to get away from this wolf pack, and it took away the legs of that injured weak bison, and the wolves jumped on it and devoured that bison, and probably spent the next week devouring that bison, and the herd got away. So very brutally, everyone has a part to play. Even the weak and injured has a part to play, because it means the pack can get away. So it's a very brutal way of looking at nature.
That's a very Jewish idea, actually, isn't it?
No, but that's the role, because we have an aging demographic. That's the role for our older people to take. They're in the position to take the role of the weak bison and to take more chance. I'm not saying go on suicide missions, exactly, but they can take more. They can take greater risks because they've lived their lives and they can take chances.
They have.
They can speak out more. They can.
No jobs to lose.
If you're 80 years old, and you know, why shouldn't you just speak your mind?
Exactly.
Well, okay. Just one other little point that arose in the second element of your list, Jez. You mentioned the word transcendental outlook, and I'm not a great one for transcendence, I must say. It worries me because it's one of these words that does not have a fixed meaning, and also has the great benefit of sort of allowing a pleasant cloud of golden wisdom and glory settle about the head of whoever uses it. And as somebody who, of course, has a permanent cloud of that kind without ever using this word, I take great offense to it. But I would like to know exactly how you would term a lack of transcendental outlook in the far right. This is what you wrote, and what you mean by that.
It's a difficult one to pin down. It is a vague concept. I basically, Ravillo P. Oliver, a very interesting man, he wrote an article once asking himself why it was that many of the top nationalists in America and in the world had a religious outlook. And you see it even today. It doesn't really matter what the religion is, whether it's even something you even conjure up yourself. It doesn't really matter, as long as you have something higher than just me in the here and now and my financial well-being and health. Whether it's orthodoxy, whether it's paganism, whether it's Christian identity, or Catholicism, isn't too important. But it helps you most people anyway, helps them get through the hard times, helps them get through the tough times. When there's nothing left, nothing left, there are no atheists on the battlefield, put it that way. It helps you focus your mind. I think prayer possibly works because it focuses your thoughts on what you want, what you need. Yeah. Now, it is a very controversial area. It is a very vague area, but there needs to be something more. There needs to be a reward in the hereafter, shall we say, for doing the good work, for fighting the good fight. Now, whether that means the hereafter just means generations to come survive, and rather than not surviving, is not too important. There needs to be something. Does that answer your question?
Let me say my bit because it's brief first.
Yeah.
How it works for me, and I need this very much, because most European people as individuals are not altogether good, and a lot of our pattern as a folk is not altogether good. And if it came down to a non-transcendental look at our people, I don't know if I could
support it.
I have to look to those, to the patterns of them that I admire, the bits of the individuals that I admire, and the patterns overall that I admire. And there's that, the fact that it's a pattern is a transcendental thing, because it's not within just one person, and it's so it goes beyond individuals and extends to the group. So it's semi-transcendent, and it's something that I honestly admire. And it and believe in, and believe should be defended, and it goes beyond the lifespan as well, and I'm hoping to be a part of it, and to stay a part of it. That's how it works for me, and it's important. I couldn't take up the cause otherwise. That's a religious function for me.
Would you count yourself as being a religious person in any way, or having a faith outlook?
In that sense, yes. I would even say that I'm not an atheist because of that.
Right. And you, James?
There is something. I mean, I'm a traditional Catholic, brought up Church of England. And I'm not sectarian in the sense that I don't mind what people's religion is. But, right. I mean, John Tyndall said, race is my religion, nation is my church. And if you look at the ancient Romans, you see, the ancient Romans, why were they so successful? The military. Now, the elite of ancient Rome may have been agnostic, atheistic, doesn't really matter. But there was an ideal for the population to look up to. There was an almost religion of Rome, shall we say. Rome was almost like a mystical god. And the Roman army was very good because it was religious. I've just watched a television series about Masada. Oh, yeah. And the Romans were very impressive, you know, perseverance, persistence, and patience, and they took Masada, which was an invincible fortress. You know, you could say today the Jews have their Masada, City of London, New York, Washington, you know, they have all these high points of power, and we've got to attack them, and anything that helps us do that is good. And if religion helps us, then so be it. But not everybody needs it. But if you look at the churches and people who are ill, people who are old, they need it. And I don't mind atheists, I don't mind agnostics, but what, you know, people, some people need religion, some people need it. And perhaps I do need it, perhaps I need it. And if it helps us fight, all to the good.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I'm not going to talk about that myself, because it would be too long, boring, and selfish of me to do so. So what I'm going to do instead, is thank you for that, because actually your list was only a list of two questions. The third question was this: anything else you wish? There is one other thing that I particularly want to talk about, and that's the London New Right. I'm very, very impressed with the vigour of the thing, with the way that it has been kept going by you. And I wanted to thank you for that. I also wanted to ask you how it works. Are you trying to drive it in a given direction, or do you take whatever you can? Are you wholly eclectic in the editorial sense? And also, what do you think the future of the forum is going to be over the next, say, 4 or 5 years? Can you see yourself carrying it on that long?
Yes, yes. The London Forum plays a very important function in, shall we say, nationalism. It is a team effort. For every person in nationalism in the media limelight on the front line, there's 20 more behind the scenes helping him, advising him, helping him. And the London Forum does not have a particular ideology, does not have a particular agenda as such. We are a broad church, shall we say. What our aim is to help create, in a sense, a leadership cadre
right.
throughout the world. We aim fairly high. We try to provide a milieu whereby people who have brains, who have the willpower, who have a conscience, who care about their people and have a bit of courage, can come along and have access to ideas, politically incorrect ideas. They can realize that they're not alone. They can then buy books that are hard to find, magazines. They can chat to people, socialize. They can hear some inspiring speeches, and they can go away inspired to carry on the fight in whatever way they wish. Mm-hmm. We get people from all organizations and none. We get people from the fringes of mainstream politics. We get people who come into it via anti-Zionism or come into it from conservative politics. There has never been an effective vehicle, an effective window display for what the mass media term the far right. Mm-hmm. And that's what, in a sense, we are. We aim to create leaders for, as this term, the far right. Because without good leaders, we will get nowhere.
Right. Do you think you are getting the best you can at this point?
Oh, we're early days yet.
Early days.
I mean, this is a long-term project. And also, it doesn't really matter whether they attend the meetings. That is beneficial to them if they do. But they can access the speeches online. And the internet's very useful in this way because...
Very useful.
People don't have to join anything. They don't have to attend meetings. They can just click online and they can read your website. They can listen to this podcast. They can Occidental Observer, Countercurrents, whatever. They can absorb the ideology mm-hmm. without any danger to themselves.
Yeah, no, and that's what the I was thinking, step. You know, you were saying that you've got people coming in from the fringes of conservatism and so forth, people who are flung far and wide. As such, you know, my question is, intellectually, is there something flowing towards us that is useful from the outside world? That's to say, from university departments, from people who are interested in Heidegger or Nietzsche. You see, I'm a recipient of quite a bit of university level papers that are generated, being posted on various websites, not so much websites actually as distribution sites, and you know, there are stuff coming out all the time from people. Every other week I get another collection of published papers, which have mostly been published by what you'd regard as being sort of low level second grade academics who are on the way up in the world, hopefully. It's not stuff from the, you know, the top guys, the guys who've got tenure and all this sort of thing. It's from the lower orders. They're still in their 20s. They're in situ. They're teaching, and they're developing their specialisms. And they publish these papers. And some of them are actually quite interesting. So, you know, it seems to me that there's a great reservoir of intellectual capacity out there that we need to be able to draw upon.
Have you seen anybody change that surprised you, and what do you think caused them to change?
Annoys me mostly. I'm still waiting to find somebody who has everything that I want to see. If I had to draw one lesson from it, is that a lot of people are searching. There's great discontent.
I want to ask that to Jez too. Have you seen anybody change that surprised you? And what caused them to change to our side?
it's very hard to get inside people's minds, really, and to work out why. You have to look at people who have changed and see what sparked them off. Let's take, I think it's Jim Phelps that has a website in America. And what changed it for him was the realization that the Jews were merely doing what was in their own interests. This is Professor McDonald's work has done a lot in this direction. And he suddenly realized what Zionism was. Let's look at Dudonne. Dudonne, he was quite a left-wing African living in France. And what changed it for him was realizing that the slave trade, Africa to America, was basically run by the Jews. They owned the ships. They were the merchants. So it varies with different people. One person I know who is
So Dudonne is going to move back to Africa, being a good national.
No, but he's on the way.
I hope so.
You know, another person. It can be I know a Christian lady who was shocked. She never realized there was any Palestinian Christians, and when she realized they were being killed by the Israelis, that started her off. So you never
that,
quite
that seems
sure.
to work well with women, the Palestinian thing.
Ah, yes, there are different things work with women than men. I have noticed that.
Yeah.
More of a leftist humanitarian outlook on them. We're the victims. We're the victims. We're whites the victims. You know, that works.
Rape works good with women too.
Sorry.
The rape statistics.
Oh yes. And also shopping. Believe it or not, there was a. No, don't mock this. These are our people. These are our people, remember. Shepherd's Bush, West London, there's a shopping centre there, a new, very plush shopping centre full of luxury goods stores. And in the wake of, I forget, a black chap being shot by police in America. I lose track of how many people. But anyway, this black chap was shot by the police in America. And for some reason, the black community decided to go into the shopping center and disrupt everything. Now you stop a woman getting to her shops. Oh my gosh, you know. that is very important. So people are sparked off on the most interesting ways. And as a people moving towards our direction from the universities, it is happening. If you look at these websites, the biggest hits are from the university towns. Because the working class are already on our wavelength. They're already instinctive. It's the middle class who've had a real big dose of liberal brainwashing. Put it this way, our movement has always been the super intellectual people and the truck drivers, the instinctive people.
The middle class tried to go one up on the working class by showing
exactly
how liberal and anti-racist they are.
Yeah, they're a bit clever. They're a bit clever, but not clever enough.
Right.
So they fall between two stools. Our work has to be, we have to aim at the intelligent people. We have to write books on Heidegger, GW. We have to aim for them, and then trickle down, we'll get the rest of the people on our side. But everything's on our side. I mean, everything is moving our way. Every issue, every news item can be looked at from our view and exploited. We haven't got the funding, though. That's the problem. We haven't got the funding. We've got the everything else on our side. We haven't got money. But when money begins to fail, when the economy falls apart, when the middle class have no respectability left to lose, then our chance comes.
Anthony's working on a currency for us. He's got his crowdfunding going, and he's going to have...
This is Anthony Mitchells, who's a Dutch specialist in positive money and in critique of usury, who we've interviewed twice, and who's a real good guy. Very plain spoken, got the whole thing down economically. What I was saying earlier about us not making a serious economic case doesn't mean that there is no economic analysis, because there's a very good economic analysis. It's still emergent, but it is based around positive money. And it's something that certainly political nationalism to date has not had the intellectual capacity to investigate, and instead it sort of talks about distributism You know, well, you've got a Catholic upbringing, so perhaps you're drawn to distributism, I don't know. But, you know, that's been a great failing in our past, not to have produced a any discourse for the primary subject of general political interest, and then to expect people to listen to the rest of what we say. No. So that brings us back to materialism, and I'm all for materialism, in fact. I just want more of it for myself, actually. Yeah, all right. Well, you know, I think that the New Right Forum is the Rolls Royce of all of our media efforts. I think that you've done a fantastic job on that. One of these days, when I feel I've got to a point where I can actually honestly look at people and say I know what I'm talking about, I will send you a mail and ask you if I can come along and give a chat.
Of course.
Worry at the present time, and the thing that stops me, is that I don't feel at this stage capable of communicating these quite recondite questions, which are key to an existentialist nationalist view. There we go. So there's not yet any point in making that effort, but I will do so in due course.
I think trying to, you know, thinking out loud, talking to people helps clarify your own views. And I think there are many people in the same boat as you, GW, who say, oh, I will get involved, but I need to just get my thinking sorted out.
Yeah,
and
I'm sure
they
never
do. You know, I think.
Well, no, it's not that I never do. I'm making progress all the time.
No, yes, in other ways.
But we shall see. You know, one of these days I'm going to do that. I'm still very, very young, as everybody knows. And I will, you know, get there. But whether anybody will want to listen is another matter. I would quite like to feel that it won't all be for nothing, but we'll see.
What I was going to... Yes, okay. I was wondering if I could read for you a poem, or part of a poem. I discovered the sonnets of Lord Alfred Douglas recently. Have you ever heard of him? He was Bosie. He was Oscar Wilde's friend.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you know about him?
Very little.
What do you know about Lord Alfred?
No. Didn't he get into trouble for some sort of wild and bohemian behaviour?
Well, possibly, but he got into real trouble by criticising Winston Churchill for being part of a Jewish conspiracy during World War
I.
Right. Winston Churchill got us into World War I because he was working for a Jewish conspiracy. And Lord Alfred Douglas spent 6 months in prison over this accusation. And while he was in prison, he wrote... His poetry was highly regarded. George Bernard Shaw, Frank Harris, Augustus John highly regarded him, compared him to Shelley. And there is still a Petrarchian Sonnet Prize awarded at Cambridge for the poetry of Lord Alfred Douglas.
All right.
Now, if you read Caspar Winterman's biography of him, it contains a poem in excelsis, but it misses out certain verses. I'm going to read for you here verse 15, and you can give me your input on it. Here we go. Stand by. The leprous spawn of scattered Israel spreads its contagion in your English blood. Teeming corruption rises like a flood whose fountain swelters in the womb of hell. Your Jew-kept politicians buy and sell in markets redolent of Jewish mud. And while the learned elders chew the cud of liquidation's fruits, they weave their spell. They weave the spell that binds the heart's desire to gold and gluttony and sweating lust. In hidden holes they stew the mandrake mess that kills the soul and turns the blood to fire. They weave the spell that turns desire to dust and postulates the abyss of nothingness. Now, what do you think of that?
Amazing.
Very brave. Very brave. What happened to him?
Spent 6 months in prison. But he lived a long life. He edited a magazine called Plain English. which basically he went down the memory hole. Lord Alfred Douglas went down the memory hole. The most people know about him is the Peter Finch film. Don't watch the Stephen Fry film of Oscar Wilde, watch the Peter Finch one. And they know him as a sort of gadfly around Oscar Wilde. Yeah. But his real important work was long after that. So I'm always interested in finding these new people, new philosophers, new novelists, new poets, who, if we can't get to people intellectually, we can get to them through other means, you know, through the arts. So this poem is impossible to find online, impossible to find that verse anyway. So I've used your radio show as a way of publicizing.
Yes.
We ought to run that poem along with the
How many verses is it?
The thing.
Let me just have a check on that. I think it's 17 verses.
So rather a lot for you to type. I was just wondering how we would publish that. If it's not available online,
you can. It's very hard to get the poem. It's very hard.
I'll just type it from Jez's.
Okay,
yeah, just in Excelsis.
Okay. Yeah. Well, look, Jez, I'm going to pack it up there and return to my family life. I repeat what I said before, which is I think that you've got a really wonderful thing going in London, which is going to be very valuable to us in the future. And I hope over a period of time, your current broad brush approach will just refine a little bit so that you will be repeating certain strands and building up a head of steam, an identity of some kind intellectually that we can say, ah, yes, the London Forum, it has achieved that. I think that would be a fine thing to put a little bit of a Schwerpunkt on it over time. But other than that, you know, I am lost in admiration, and I wish you all the best, and thank you very much for your time.
I started with European Outlook. Can I end with a bit of European Outlook? It says, what do I believe in? Could I end with that?
Yep, sure.
Okay, right. Okay.
Daniel, then you finish up.
Or should I just say thank you now and let him end with that?
Right, okay.
Let me say thank you first before you read that.
So okay, I'll end.
It's been a pleasure, Jez. I'm really delighted with your outlook. It's been a very pleasant surprise.
Do come to London. Do come to London.
Look, I will, and I look forward to more.
Yeah.
Right, so what do you believe in? I believe in the eternal, primal, and primordial truths that man has subconsciously believed in since the dawn of time. I believe in self-awareness, self-actualization, self-becoming, and in self-overcoming. I believe in human nature and know that it has never changed and never will. I believe in the power of nature, the power of race, the power of culture, the power of tradition, and the power of religion, and the power of identity to form an indestructible combination that brings out the best in human nature and that protects a people from the worst of storms. I believe in the right of all peoples, races, ethnic groups, tribes, to pursue their own destiny as a people free from interference. And to do this, they require their own homogenic nation state, and crucially, control over their own homogenic nation state. I believe in authenticity, and therefore support the organic over the inorganic, and the natural over the artificial. I believe that the current situation of internationally approved nation states and borders will be swept away by the instinctive yearning for identity and the thirst for freedom, and those smaller, healthier, homogenic states will emerge. I believe we were put on this earth to fight evil, and that the greatest evil in this world today is the drive to create a drab, one-world slave state made up of a mass of miscegenated, mongrelized, mixed-up, multiracial, mammon-worshipping morons. Morons without culture, religion, traditions. Perfect slaves, as they won't even know that they are slaves. And tyrannically ruling over them will be a secret elite of mind and money manipulators. A secret elite that will zealously guard its own religion, its own race, its own traditions and culture. I believe this evil will come about if we do not fight it with all our might. The fight against this evil is the only cause worth fighting for. It is the cause. Nothing else really matters. To that end, I support all those without exception who oppose such a horrific nightmare future. I therefore believe in cooperation between peoples in order to fight this one world menace. And to that end, they should be free to voluntarily form alliances, federations, and leagues for mutual protection. I believe that we have everything on our side: nature, instincts, genetics, sociobiology, wisdom, and common sense. Everything indeed, except money. Whereas the one worlders, whether they cloak themselves in capitalism, communism, or liberalism, only have money on their side. I believe the world is heading for an almighty crash, financially, economically, socially, medically, and environmentally. And in consequence, the power of money will fail. And then the evil that seeks to enslave the earth will falter in its advance, and then our time will come. I believe in the power of belief, and I believe that we will win. The white race makes very good warriors, even when we fight in other people's interests, whether we talk about the plutocracy of the British Empire or whatever. But when we fight in our own interests, we are invincible. It's time we woke from our slumber. It's time the lions woke up and showed the jackals and hyenas who we really are. The time for fear is over. We've nothing left to lose and everything to gain. The time for fear is over. It's time to fight. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.